This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey everyone, welcome to Pop Culture Confidential, a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Thank you so much for joining me. Now, a visit with Lord Grantham himself. Hugh Bonneville is with us this week, star of Downton Abbey, A New Era. It's been over a decade since the much-beloved franchise first began, and the incredible cast is back in this new installment, including Maggie Smith, Elizabeth McGovern, Imelda Staunton, Jim Carter, and so many more. In this new go-around, a film crew sets up to make a silent movie at Downton Abbey, with Mary overseeing it, and Robert and several family members head to the south of France to uncover news of an unexpected inheritance.
Have you told them, Lady Grantham?
She's told us nothing.
Do sit down. I've come into possession of a villa in the south of France.
What villa?
Start at the beginning.
Years ago, before you were born, I met a man.
They spend a few days together and he gives her a house.
You never thought to turn it down?
Do I look as if I'd turn down a villa in the south of France?
A telephone call for you, my lord.
Mr. Barber is a producer and director.
He wants to make a film at Downton.
A moving picture at Downton?
Would there be some stars, famous ones?
I think it's a horrible idea. Actresses plastered in makeup and actors just plastered.
There is something about him, like a wild animal ready to spring.
Ready to spring on you, you mean?
Action!
Cut! Cut!
Sorry.
The modern world comes to Downton.
Mr. Hugh Bonneville, thank you so much for joining me.
Hello, Christina. Hi, how are you?
So as someone who's worked in production a lot, I get nervous heartburn thinking about the wrangling, the production schedule planning of this enormous, fabulous cast and crew for yet another go-around. What was it like to get everyone back together again?
Well, it's a great tribute to our executive producers, you know, principally Gareth Neame and Liz Troubridge and our writer creator Julian Fellowes, because it is, as many people have said, like herding cats. You know, we weren't under contract, we weren't obliged to do either movie, and the fact that we all wanted to, and I think Gareth likened it to everyone standing around a swimming pool and joining hands and just agreeing to jump at the same moment, and that's what it took. So great credit to them, and we got there eventually. And of course, you know, as I said, you know, if none of us had got on in the first place, we would never have come back for more. Why, you know, if you can't bear people, why work with them again? So that's a great, you know, testament that from day one we've managed to stay friends and work colleagues. And it's, you know, knowing that there's an audience out there that is keen and expectant really helps drive things forward.
So I want to tread lightly here as to not spoil, but suffice to say, Lord Grantham is really put through the emotional ringer in this one, as a son, as a husband, as a house owner. Where do we find him now?
Well, yes, I was thrilled having basically the highlight of in the first movie was I got to move some chairs around. and so I was delighted to discover that Julian Fellowes had created such a rich storyline for me in this particular movie. We find him at the beginning of the movie in denial, as usual, about the state of affairs at Downton Abbey, and that things are just going to plod on as they always have in a stately fashion, but until his daughter shows him the hole in the roof and the rain dripping through into the buckets, and that something has to be done. So maybe he should accept the offer of a film company coming to make a movie at Downton Abbey. At the same time, there's also a mystery thread appears in the form of a villa that has come into the possession of my mother, Lady Violet. And we've been invited to the south of France to meet the owners, the current owners, and to try and understand why and in what circumstances it was left to Violet in someone's will. And so that's a fun departure. So those are the two hairs that are set running, and Robert's part in them.
Knowing this character for over a decade now, how have you come to understand that he handles the most difficult emotional things?
Well, like all good British aristocrats, he buries them as deeply as possible and pretends they're not happening. He has more affection, you know, more emotion comes out in relation to his animals, particularly his dogs, than it does to his own family. And I think that's true of many aristocrats of that type. But he goes on, in this particular film, as you say, quite a big emotional journey. But the Robert that we met in the very first episode, I don't think we as human beings change that much. Our experiences inform our personalities, and we grow in that sense. But I think we're still seeing the same sort of Robert that we did initially.
Maggie Smith has a great line, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember, but she says about marriage, British couples don't talk, but they trust each other. Would you agree?
I think, again, I mean, I think Julian Fellowes, who understands this sort of strata of society very well, he seems to understand all the characters very well. But I think that sense of the British aristocratic marriage where where a lot is unspoken. I think the emotions that... Julian always said that he based Robert partly on his own father, who a man he greatly admired. And I think who did display his emotions. And Robert does from time to time display his emotions. He has to in this particular iteration as well. And I think the connection between him and Cora, even though they've been tested at times in our stories, is extremely strong, and it's made stronger in this storyline as well for all sorts of reasons. Yeah, their affection for each other is undeniable and it's tangible. And he does express his emotions, not just to the dog.
So Simon Curtis is behind the directorial chair this time around. So you and his real-life wife, Elizabeth, have worked on three different projects together. Is there any tension there?
Yeah, no, quite the opposite. It's it's led to a complete shorthand, and B, I in fact played Simon in one of those projects. We did a mini sitcom, really, in which Elizabeth played herself and I played her fictional husband, and Simon directed it and produced it. So we've been friends for a very long time and have a wonderful rapport both on screen and off. So that was easy peasy. And Simon, you know, has brought a whole new visual chemistry to the film. You know, he's really opened it up, and he, in any movie, you know, the spirit of the director is felt on screen. He's a character as a man of great warmth and ebullience, and he wants everyone to have a good time, and he spends just as much time on making the daily quiz as he does his shot list. So he wants everyone to be entertained at all times, and that gives a great energy on set for both the cast and the crew.
So now when the Crawleys visit the south of France, how more elaborate of a trip is it when young Hugh and the Bonnevilles slapped the canvas tent on your car and drove to France in the 60s, 70s, which I understand that you did?
Oh, yes, quite a different thing. Yeah, we didn't have it. When we went camping in our little old Volvo down through France, we didn't have an entourage of two or three other cars carrying the luggage. It was just literally... three kids squished in the back and the tent and the roof. So yeah, quite different to the Crawleys, but no less magical. There is something, you know, I've always loved traveling in Europe, and you know, that spirit of adventure and finding new places. And so for the Crawleys to go to the south of France, particularly at this era, you know, when it really wasn't fashionable to, or was only just becoming fashionable to visit the south of France, because obviously being in the heat in the summer was, you know, anathema to society. And Scott Fitzgerald and you know, his like, and then the film stars had started making it fashionable to go there. And so that's what Lady Edith wants to go and capture. And so for us to, you know, us as a the Crawley family to visit and get out of their, if you like, comfort zone was intriguing. And of course, you know, just for us as actors, it was just a joy to go, you know, to go to the south of France and make a movie.
I guess you've traveled to Scotland, but this is sort of the first time you've taken Downton that far, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, at one point, we were actually going to have to pretend that Scotland was France because we were shooting during the pandemic.
Oh, right.
We weren't sure if we were going to be able to get to France because of the restrictions. And so there was a plan Z, Plan A and Plan Z, and the poor schedulers and the producers, how they, you know, they kept their hair on, because they were going to have to stitch two or three villas that they'd found in Scotland that looked vaguely French and try and stitch it all together. But in fact, we were able to stick to Plan A, and we did have to quarantine when we got to France in three hotels. We took over three hotels and had to quarantine there. Which was no hardship, I have to say. When England was suffering, you know, incredible wind and rain, we were actually forced to sit by a swimming pool for a week before we could start filming. So it was a tough gig, but someone had to do it. Yeah. it was the first time in it, and you know, obviously it really suits the, you know, the world of the big screen to be able to open up the canvas and go to this extraordinary vista of Côte d'Azur.
You were mentioning one of the storylines is this film crew that comes to Downton to make a film, which of course makes Lord Grantham a bit uneasy, quite a different culture between the film folk and the Downton residents and staff. I was just wondering, when you guys ascended...
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to the Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.
The first time on Highclere Castle, I know that you do a lot of studio work, but did it feel the same when you film folk came to this castle?
Well, I think we now know how Lord and Lady Carnarvon, who obviously live at Highclere Castle, how they feel about these ghastly actors traipsing all over their beautiful furniture. And what's the line? Something like actresses, you know, plastered in makeup and actors just plastered. so the in-joke about the industry having to save a country house is not without, yes, there's not without a knowing nod and a wink to the Carnarvons. Not that their house was falling down or indeed had a leaky roof, but it certainly helped. I think our presence has helped to place that famous silhouette of the castle. Yes. As a brand around the world now, and their visitor numbers have rocketed and will stay up for a while to come, I think.
So the film folk did good. In
the film folk did good, certainly in that regard, and I'm sure it saved. It will have saved the Downton. From the look on Lady Mary's face when she looks at the size of the cheque that they're going to receive, I think their roof is going to be all right, yeah.
So when you guys are all there for like a wedding scene, or maybe even, you know, Dame Maggie's there, Imelda, Michelle, Hugh, and you're all dressed up, and then between takes, who's the first one to crack the joke?
I'd say Alan Leach as Mr. Branson. Yeah, yeah. He's, yeah? Yes, he's the Irish Blarney. We all get on. I mean, say the wedding scene, which is no big spoiler because it's like most, you know, trailers these days, the entire plot is in the trailer, which seems a shame to me, but there we are. The film opens with a wedding, which is yes. Tom Branson's wedding to Lucy. And so that was 3 days. We shot that in Suffolk, and this beautiful, this little hamlet, which had a beautiful house and a church all within the same sort of, you know, precinct, as it were. We had to, as always, we were lucky with the rain gods. I mean, throughout the shooting of Downton, I was talking to one of our producers the other day, you know, whenever it mattered, we got the weather we needed, which was so lucky. I can remember in the first season, and the because obviously these big set piece scenes take not just one day, they take, you know, two or three. And so the party, the garden party at the end of the very first season when war is announced, you know, we were blessed with beautiful weather for those 3 days, consistent weather for those 3 days. The cricket match in season three, it poured with rain. They had to move it, I think, once or twice through the schedule. But when we did get there, it poured with rain. They had to get a special machine from the local cricket club to sort of sweep the water off the pitch. And it stopped raining just as we were about to start shooting. It took 3 days to shoot. And at 5 to 7 on the last day, it started raining. So we were, you know, again, there was a window there. And equally for the wedding sequence in the second movie, there was a pretty heavy downpour where we had to sort of rejig some shooting. But we spent quite a lot of time under canvas over those 3 days, just chewing the fat. And yeah, Alan's the go-to storyteller.
And do you have a practical joker?
Well, I suppose Alan and I get up to a few tricks when we do scenes together. But no, we're fairly respectful of each other, but that would be giving away secrets.
Oh. I've always found very fascinating, you know, the work of a historical cultural consultants on films. I know you've worked with quite a few. What are some of the things, particularly on this film, that you really learned?
Well, Alistair Bruce, who we call the Oracle, because he's been our historical advisor throughout, and he's been of huge value to us as the cast. I think he's been the bane of the props department's life because, you know, he will be very particular about knives, forks, spoons, you know, what goes where, because he works in the very much in the royal household, or has done. And he says basically that when it comes to the next coronation, he sort of is part of the team that decides where everybody sits. So he's very much about etiquette, hierarchy, structure. And so at the beginning of each season during the TV show, he used to give us a sort of social historical perspective of where Britain was in 1914, 1916, 1922, whatever. And so again, for 1928, for this movie, he was extremely helpful in terms of just the look of the way that people carry themselves. I mean, you know, famously in the very first season, we had to reshoot a scene because my hands slip into my trouser pockets. From then on, I had in my white tie and tails, I had a suit made with no pockets, so I didn't fall into that trap.
Smart.
Now, of course, you know, who knows? But of course, people put their hands in their pockets, but we just decided, it was decided that no one would cross their legs in this show, and no one would put their hands in their pockets unless they were, you know, unless it was a particular character. And so things like that just give the show a certain style, a certain look.
Is there any interesting etiquette that you've learned through the years that you've brought home to the Bonneville house?
Well, no. One that always intrigued me, actually, which I'd never thought of, was that nobody ever, if you noticed, that the butlers and the servants, they never knock. They just melt into a room. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, you know, the family would spend the entire day saying, come in, come in. I said, come in. And so that's interesting, which is, again, is why there's always been this sense that the servants know far more about what's happening in the upstairs world.
I don't think my teenagers would appreciate me melting in.
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So no, I haven't taken that one. I don't mind you. Yeah, wouldn't expect my son to knock if I was. yeah, the idea of melting into rooms, I think, is quite an interesting one.
You mentioned the pandemic. I understand that you volunteered for the vaccine effort mm-hmm. during the pandemic. I was wondering how people reacted to seeing you there, the national treasure that you've become.
Well, on the whole, people didn't recognize me because I was wearing a mask. So that was quite good. No, it was, I feel very passionately about the vaccination program, and you know, wanted to do my bit. I faint at the sight of a needle, so I was just outside with a clipboard being bossy, you know, stand over there, you know, get in line, 6 feet apart, all that.
You've called Lord Grantham slowly progressive, which I thought was a very interesting and good way of putting him. Do you think he would have done something like this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was a storyline we will get that Julian Fellowes explored about in 1926. There was a possible storyline that was going to be about the general strike, and that Robert was going to drive a bus. So I think he'd be, as you say, slowly progressive. And I think I've also called him, you know, conservative by birth and liberal by nature, in that he is, you know, he even though it does take Lady Mary to drag him kicking and screaming sometimes into the sense of modernity, he does accept, you know, more contemporary views than perhaps some of his colleagues, like
Fellows has said he would have been a Brexiteer, and I'm not sure.
Well, I know he said that. I'm not so sure, because I think he's I like to think of Robert as slightly more open-minded than that. I don't think he's a little Englander at all.
What do you attribute the lasting power and love for this story that's gone on now for over a decade, and I'm sure will continue?
I think I can only equate it to my own experience of reading that very first script before it was cast. And I read very vivid characters who popped off the page. I could start seeing them, even though they were, you know, they, in my mind's eye, like when you read a novel, you start casting them in your head. And they all had their individual voices, their individual journeys. The stories were intriguing. And when it came to the last page, I wanted to know what happened next. And I think that has translated to the big, to the screen and then to the big screen. And Julian Fellowes has a great imagination and a great ability to tell myriad stories all at once and to keep us hooked on who's doing what to whom and what are they going to do next. And it, you know, it looks fabulous. And the world does seem a, you know, Julian always says he writes from the default position that human beings try to be good. They try to do the right thing. They may do bad things, mind you, in the current climate, you think, I don't believe that at all. But on the whole, human beings try to do the right thing. And we're all struggling around the world to try and do the right thing. And these stories, I think, allow us to escape into that hope for an hour and a half, 2 hours to enjoy a bit of fantasy that the world can be a better place.
Mr. Bonwell, thank you so much for your time. I wish you so much luck with this movie and a really nice summer. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. All the best.
Thank you very much to Hugh Bonneville. The movie is Downton Abbey, A New Era. And thank you so much for joining me. Please subscribe to Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.